Wherever you're listening, if you are in Australia, you're on Aboriginal land. At the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, we pay respects to the elders and acknowledge their ongoing custodianship of the country where we made this podcast and of the country you're listening to it on. Before Twitter, there was TalkBack. If you wanted to tell the world what was on your mind, about the trains running late again, the latest geopolitical crisis, your favourite Hemsworth, you rang up the radio. But that wasn't always the case.
If you look at the influence that talkback radio has had in the last, 30-odd years, it's been huge. When we say talkback, it's basically just people calling in, even calling in and requesting songs. It was illegal for a long time.
Talkback, which sort of became the bread and butter of AM radio at the end of the century, wasn't even allowed until 1967 because you weren't allowed to broadcast what were private conversations. Like, the phone lines were regarded as private, so it doesn't matter if people consented to having their phone calls on the radio, it just wasn't allowed.
Talkback comes in many forms. For politicians, it's been a way to sell their policies. Paul Keating said, "If you educate John Laws, you educate Middle Australia." The rest of us used it for everything, from having a whinge to sharing our most intimate secrets.
There was a great talk back where a woman said, the topic was, how did you first know when your husband was having an affair? And she rang in to say, well, I knew Matthew was having an affair because he said he was out with Danny. He said, well, how did you know? He said, because I was in bed with Danny at the time. I think we invented a segment, which I think is still used now, called Should I Go or Should I Stay? And that's where we get the, someone comes on board and they talk about their relationship and then the whole audience gets on and says whether they should leave or whether they should stay. So it was a sort of a confessional style of radio that I was involved in, which I really loved.
You've tuned into Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. I'm Patrick McIntyre, and this is episode 4, I Just Called to Say I Love You. When radio first appeared in the 1920s, it was a one-way format. We tuned into whatever was on air, just as we would later do with television. The United States got into listener participation early in the 1930s, but in Australia, privacy regulations, yes, they were a problem even back then, made it illegal even to phone in and request a song.
This is Andy True, your science correspondent. Talkback 101. Before April 17, 1967, engaging in talkback radio discussions was illegal in Australia. The rise of television in 1956 prompted radio to innovate, leading to the introduction of open line or beeper phone programs by stations like Melbourne's 3AK and Sydney's 2UW in 1963. However, these were shut down after 6 months due to legal restrictions on recording and broadcasting telephone conversations. The regulations were finally lifted on April 17, 1967, marking the birth of legal talkback radio. Pioneers like Ormsby Wilkins, Barry Jones, Mike Walsh, Buzz Kennedy, John Laws, and Norman Banks reshaped radio schedules to embrace this revolutionary format. Despite early skepticism, talkback radio flourished, covering a range of topics from politics to health. 3DB even introduced a buy, sell, or swap program named Tradio. Discover how this once forbidden pleasure became the dynamic landscape of talkback radio in Australia. Back to you, Patrick.
So, after a lot of pressure from the industry, the government lifted the restrictions and away we went.
Can you give any explanation why, since the give way to the right rule of driving cars has come forth?
Yes.
So many cars, you see, have got the right side all dented in. And do you feel that the rule could be more rigidly enforced?
People started calling in from everywhere about everything. Some people complained about the youth.
They can't spell, they can't write a thank you. And I really feel that what I'm disappointed, and I think half the youth of today, is because that they gave away the cane and the strap. And I think that if they had more of that in the schools today, we wouldn't see these barefooted, long-haired people at the university.
Others tried to flog their carpets.
Good afternoon, this is Tradio.
Oh, good afternoon.
What can I do to help you?
I would like to sell a nice carpet square.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12 by 15, and it's the large floral pattern.
Yes.
And it's been very well looked after, you know. And
no bugs in the carpet.
Hmm?
No bugs. Bugs, you know.
Little, whereabouts?
No bugs. No little creepy crawly creatures.
Oh, no. No, definitely not. Oh, no.
Literally like Facebook Marketplace for radio.
Now TalkBack had arrived, presenters had to figure out how to make it work. Here's Chris O'Neill, a curator at the National Film and Sound Archive.
Before the presenters became really adept at that, it was a real novelty. It was, you know, advertised in the newspapers as, hey, talk to us about whatever you want. People would just call up and ask what night their bin night was. It was kind of like people didn't really know what to do.
Eventually, we all got the hang of it, and presenters began putting their own spin on the medium.
There was all sorts of like advice programs and gardening programs like there are today. It wasn't always as completely toxic as it might be today, but it really kind of opened the democratic floodgates, having that citizen participation of media and broadcasting.
TalkBack had something for everyone. Listeners loved hearing themselves and people like them on the radio. Politicians loved the direct access to voters. Prime Minister John Howard even set up a studio in his Sydney office just for doing radio sessions. And high-profile presenters loved the attention. For decades, two Sydney titans competed to be TalkBack's top dog. Alan Jones, who won 100 rating surveys in a row, and John Laws, famous for his golden Sennheiser microphone. Sometimes on competing stations, sometimes on the same one, they were always controversial. Whether it was for how they insulted their own listeners on air, or how sometimes their personal opinions were actually paid for by sponsors. Jones retired in 2020. Laws, who retired in 2007, is back on air at the age of 88, over on 2SM. These powerful personalities paved the way for the shock jocks who built careers by baiting their audiences.
I think the ones that could manage to, you know, make a program out of the were really good at, you know, picking the calls that could either move their own agenda along or would bump up against their own agenda, but, you know, be able to make the callers look stupid. So, yeah, it became sort of an art of that give and take two-way thing if you have really succeeded in doing.
TalkBack became a feature of radio's new peak periods, the early morning and late afternoon drive time slot. NFSA curator Amy Butterfield explains.
You sort of see radio as trying to figure itself out, like what can it do that TV can't do? And I think in this period, like car radios existed before the 1950s, but the car radio becomes really big when you can't watch TV while you're driving. So there's this time slot that TV can't use, but radio can. And it's like, it's the commute hour, you know, early morning, late afternoon. So they're trying to carve out a new sort of market, audience share. It's a thing that encourages participation of older listeners rather than younger listeners. TalkBack, it had a kind of different character early on. It wasn't explicitly about the news or politics necessarily, or the event, the current affairs. People would talk back about all sorts of things.
I've done a million talk back topics over the years. I'm the queen of talk back topics.
This is Wendy Harmer.
I have been in the radio biz on the radio for about 17 years or so, probably a bit more, probably almost 20. actually, from AM radio to ABC radio to commercial FM radio. So I've sort of been, you know, I know my way around a microphone by now. I've done, oh gosh, how many zillion sessions of talkback. There was one on Radio National I loved, actually. This was in the years of the Iron John movement and the masculinist movement and, you know, men going on vision quests and getting in touch with their inner masculinity. And I remember interviewing one of these blokes who took these men away for these visualization sort of weekends and sessions. And he said that one of the little visualizations they used to do was imagine which flower their penis resembled. And so I had talk back on Radio National with guys going, well, a zinnia, because it's tall, it's straight, and, you know, another guy going, a rose or a pen. And then this guy gets on, he says, self-raising flower.
Talk back wasn't just entertaining. It also provided a sense of community, a place where listeners could process significant events together.
I remember the morning after Princess Diana had died, and I just sort of sat there and fielded for hours and hours, just women absolutely distressed and so sad and all crying, and I was crying too. I remember on the morning of September 11, we asked all the drivers in Sydney to turn on their headlights in solidarity, and we just watched as the city lit up, you know, in front of our eyes from our tower in Bondi Junction. So I have been behind the microphone when, you know, big seismic things have happened, and it feels like a real privilege to have been there.
TalkBack's ability to get listeners to share their secrets was unmatched for decades, until a new generation decided to let it all hang out on social media. But unlike social media, which is about projecting yourself to the world, TalkBack's appeal lies in its sense of intimacy.
Radio is a very intimate medium. You mean you can't see me? I can't see you. So you do feel like it's very secretive.
I'm talking directly into your headphones, or as it was in those days, your Walkman or your clock radio. It's the intimacy of it. That's why radio works. It still does. Radio builds communities.
I'm Dr. Sally Coburn. Some would know me better as Dr. Feelgood.
Sally is a real doctor, and it was one of her patients who worked in radio that gave her her first gig.
She said, we're about to do a sex program and I put you up for the host job. And I went, I don't know anything about sex. And she said, what are you talking about? You're my GP. You know, you do my pap smears. You prescribe my contraception, la, 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 la. And I said, okay, let's give it a go.
And the phones ran hot.
I used to trundle in there on a Sunday night at 9:30 for 10 o'clock, and microphones went on. We had to keep the telephones turned off until a moment before the show went to air because we would get inundated with calls. I thought that was normal. I used to get a sack of mail every week. I thought that was normal. People often say to me, oh, why did you talk about sex? You know, why did you go and do that? You're a GP. And I said, because no one else would do it this way. I wanted it to be fun. I didn't want it to be sneaky dirty, but I needed to explain stuff. And I think one of the things I said a lot was, look, I'm a doctor, I'm a GP, I can talk about pathology, I can talk about, you know, the diseases. But when it comes to relationships, the only people who are experts in a relationship are the people in it. It needed to be real. And you said, you know, that it was frank. Well, it was as if you were going to see a GP. We talk frankly, you know. And I used to say, I remember some people would ring up and say, I've got a, oh, can I say that word? And I said, well, I'm sure you can. Make it anatomical and then you can say it. So it was really nice for people to be able to feel they could talk openly.
For every young person thrilled to finally get that excruciating question answered, there were probably parents equally thrilled not to be asked.
I think parents were probably quite happy their kids were listening to this. In fact, I had lots of parents writing to me saying, look, we were listening in the other room. And I used to say, if you're a parent, you can use this as a springboard with your kids. But can I just say, they're not just kids who are listening. I mean, we had many older people listening, wanting relationship advice. And I think that was really good. To have older people as well.
People had been turning to the radio for advice since 1969, when Father Jim McLaren launched a Sunday night counselling show on 2UW and 2SM. It ran for more than two decades, and some listeners just kept calling in.
I remember one woman, she rang over a period of about 3 months, I think, and she was in an abusive relationship, and she was trying to leave the relationship, and she took strength from us, and her partner was evidently a police officer. So I don't know what state she was in now, but he was a police officer and told her, no matter where you go, I will find you. You know, that sort of threatening stuff. And I told her, I said, safe houses are called that for a good reason, and I don't believe that the police officers know where they are. But you need support before you can go, and you need to, you know, get some friends together. Anyway, she rang me, I don't know, would have been 3 months later, and she left. She got out. She's not one of those statistics, which, let's face it, there's too many of. I think we were often taking the place of what are now the lifelines and the 1-800 numbers.
Sally discovered that radio is less anonymous than you might think.
People stop me in the street even these days and say, well, usually after I've opened my mouth, often they don't recognise the visage, but they say, you changed my life, or you made me think differently about things.
Plenty of people were keen to talk about sex, but just as many were in the mood for love. Richard Mercer proved that with his phenomenally popular show, Love Song Dedications.
He never attempted to solve problems. He never tried to go, okay, I hear that this is, you're going through a divorce and you're unhappy. Have you thought about, like, he never pretended to be a psychologist. He literally just offered them an ear and often just validation and then a Celine Dion song. And those are just such a beautiful trio, I think. Just like validation, an ear and a love song.
This is Bonnie Lee Dodds.
I'm a longtime fan of Richard Mercer and Love Song Dedications. And particularly at a time, I think, in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, where toxic masculinity or conversations around feelings, particularly for men, were not a really commonplace. The idea of having this like stalwart of radio lead the charge on being emotionally vulnerable, like stunning.
Richard Mercer had a long career as a program director and announcer. But the baritone broadcaster didn't become a household name until he hosted Love Song Dedications. During its 16-year run from 1997 until 2013 on Mix 106.5, Richard became known as the Love God.
Like, it was just in cabs, it was in takeaway shops, it was just kind of everywhere.
Yeah, he really took over our lives for a little while, and we love that. My name's Tom Hogan. I'm besties with Bonnie Lee Dodds.
Bonnie and Tom are the team behind the Missing Richard Mercer podcast.
It's just this thing that we loved, and we're just like, there's nothing else like that, or at least at the time.
Unashamed, like, affectionate, public love for someone was just such a special find, I think, and a little very specific pocket in Australian radio history that hasn't really repeated to that height, that extent.
We didn't just do a podcast. We did a whole show and we toured it for a long time. And now we fend off anyone who's having a wedding who thinks that they can get him.
Yeah. Once every couple of months, we get asked for Rich's contact details from people who are like, yeah, but David and I got engaged on Love Song Dedication. So it's really important to us that we can reach him. We're like, it's not our job.
The format was simple. Listeners would call up and share their love story with Richard.
Someone will announce themselves and, you know, express their feelings. And he's just like, well, I've lined up Celine Dion for you. So, and they're like, thank you.
Yeah, it's been great.
Excellent. So you're happy. You're not going anywhere. You want this to be the first anniversary of many to come.
Yes. And we also like to thank our friend for setting us up on a blind date.
Is that how it started for you two? Wow.
Yes,
it
was very exciting.
So it obviously went very smoothly, that first date, did it?
Yeah, it went perfectly.
And look at it. As a result, 1 year later, here you are, very happy. So thank you to your friends. Enjoy getting home, Kate, with your special lady, Emily. And as I send your song out to her from Celine Dion, is there anything else you'd like to get across to her?
Just that she means the world to me, and I'm just so happy that I'm with her, and she's the one.
There's one from like a kid who's in school and just wants to dedicate a song to someone he likes because she's got a great sense of humor and she kicked the ball to him. And it was just like, we're like, oh my God, like that, like he didn't know what to do. And so he called up the radio show and he's just like so sincere about that. And he's just like, I finally get to do it.
I think surprising for the time, the amount of queer dedications that come through on the show as well, which I think was just not a commonplace conversation, you know, like a completely unpoliticized expression of love between two women. And so there was one, I think there's that back-to-back where she calls one week and she goes, I think I'm gonna ask her to marry me, which also extraordinarily beautiful, knowing that at that point in time, same-sex marriage was not legal in Australia. And then 2 weeks later, she calls up and she's like absolutely on cloud nine. And she's like, Richard, I just want to let you know that I did it. I asked her to marry me and she said yes. And I'm so happy. And he's like, that's great. There's that beautiful dedication where somebody calls up and he's like, oh yeah, I want to dedicate one to the old ball and chain. And he just is like, what's she like? And like, tell me more. And by the end of it, he's like, yeah, I know, I really love her. She's like the best person I've ever known. And it's just in the space of 30 seconds, he has completely undone this like piss take to being like, I really love you. Have a good night. I'm coming home, baby. It's gorgeous.
Each call was followed by a song, but music wasn't really the point.
We did manage to get in contact with him and just sort of like ask him a whole bunch of questions about what this was. And I think the songs was second place. I think for him, it was more about communication and it was more about giving people space to talk. And the song was just part of the format. But that sort of, it became so intertwined. He sort of says that it was also for himself to sort of like get better at understanding how to express and how to feel and what other people feel. And it was like, so that is sort of part of it. You can hear his final dedication. He sort of says all this. It's like part of the final dedication is him saying, like, I was able to express myself and I'm able to share love now and I've got the words for it.
Well, that's our program for the last 16 and a half years. Thank you so much for supporting it and being a part of it. It's been one heck of a ride. I'm going to leave you tonight, though, with one last dedication, and this is very special for me because my lady, Sharon, the lady I love, sent this in. And I just think it's beautiful, so I'll share this as my parting gift, and I hope you enjoy her words for me. Sharon writes, "My dear Richard, I thought that I'd send this to you because as you wind down your show to move on to exciting new challenges, I thought that after all these years of you giving out other people's dedications, that you more than anyone deserve one. The thing is, it's hard to pick a song for you, Richard, because you are every song. You are music to me. But saying that, there is a song that when I hear..."
So, where did all that love go? We still use music to express emotion, although you're more likely to make a playlist than a mixtape these days. But did love song dedications expose us as a country of hopeless romantics?
I think his legacy is honestly like the just even cracking open the ability to talk about your feelings in a really public way. He created, you know, the idea of a radio personality that existed for good and that we can connect to radio and we can connect to radio personalities in a positive way. I'm thankful that there was a space for a little romantic kids like me to listen to something and feel validated by the idea of big love. Like that's such a nice memory to have, is listening and hoping that maybe the boy I had a crush on would dedicate a song to me over the radio.
It felt so powerful back then. It just felt like people just needed the outlet to express themselves.
When Talkback came along, radio changed from being something you listen to something you engage with, by giving people a place to vent, to sell their goods, and to get life-changing advice. It helped connect friends and lovers, neighbours and strangers. You can think of Talkback as an early form of user-generated content, and the way it encouraged people to get personal influenced some of today's most popular platforms.
Just having your voice transmitted felt like a powerful act, I think. Which is, I guess, explains the podcast boom and, you know, out of social media boom of like, yeah, your voice is relevant, you can express yourself. But yeah, just there was no other avenue.
Radio has always been great at bringing people together. But while the earliest programming was designed to get everyone listening, over time, radio also created places for communities to hold their own conversations.
when I lived in both Broken Hill and Alice Springs at various times. I love listening to the radio when I'm in those towns, and especially community radio, because everybody knows everybody and you're often hearing about stories that are really localized. They're stories that have meaning and putting faces to the names of people and projects that they're working on.
In the next episode, we explore how community radio created a safe space for people often overlooked by the mainstream, like the queer community and First Nations Australians. This has been Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. Thank you to our guests, Wendy Harmer, Sally Coburn, Bonnie Lee Dodds, Tom Hogan, our NFSA curators, Chris Arneal and Amy Butterfield, and our science correspondent, Andy True. You can visit our Radio 100 digital exhibition at nfsa.gov.au. If you've enjoyed Who Listens to the Radio, don't forget to rate or review wherever you get your podcasts.